Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Congress is back in Washington for a mini session. A likely topic in the halls, the Bush-era tax cuts, set to expire for all Americans on December 31st. Today, Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner joined other White House officials in saying he's encouraged by House Minority Leader John Boehner's comments over the weekend. Boehner, who's been a staunch defender of keeping the cuts for the wealthiest 3% of Americans, said on CBS's Face the Nation he'll now consider voting with the administration to only extend the cuts for individuals making under $200,000 and families making under $250,000.
If the only option I have is to vote for those at $250,000 and below, of course I'm going to do that. But I'm going to do everything I can to fight to make sure that we extend the current tax rates for all Americans.
Well, is this a sign that Republicans are seeing negative voter reaction to tax cuts for the very wealthy? Or was this a brilliant parry by Republicans taking one of the Democrats' biggest criticisms of them off the table? Senior congressional correspondent Gail Chadwick of the Christian Science Monitor has just returned from Boehner country in Ohio. We want to hear about her trip. But first, Gail, what do you think happened here? Why this remark yesterday from John Boehner?
Well, I think people are overlooking a very important word in that remark, and that's the word if. He was asked a pretty narrow question. You know, if under House rules this is the only vote you're going to get on the tax cuts, will you take half a loaf, three-quarters of a loaf, or let everyone see the biggest tax cut in history? And he said, I would be open to passing everything but the highest, extension for the highest. But that if is very important, and you'll notice immediately after that the Senate, which of course is what has blocked just about everything the House has done for the Obama administration, the Senate quickly said Republicans are uniformly opposed to extending tax cuts for only part of the tax cuts. They wanted to see it all the way. And that five senators on the Democratic side have already joined them. So whatever Mr. Boehner says, and for whatever motive, it's a non-starter. It's just not going to get through the Senate.
Well, let's just stay there 1 second, though, because, Gail, some would say that his comment and reaction to it does give the Democrats those five Democrats who felt they had a vote with Republicans maybe a little bit of wiggle room. And we're also thinking that Boehner and other Republicans may have seen some recent polling. Last Friday, the Gallup poll showed 44% of Americans were just fine with letting the cuts expire for the wealthiest Americans. Maybe more important, among independents, that number went up. 56% of independent voters are against extending the cuts for the rich. So could Republicans possibly be seeing that this is maybe a non-starter for them?
Well, I think they want to give it at least a couple more weeks, because the issue that's coming up this week, next, and the whole month, really, is jobs. Who has the more credible approach to jobs, especially small business? Now, that small business bill that passed the House is now up before the Senate on Tuesday, and this time they'll have the Republican votes they need to get it across. I think for just the reason you're mentioning, Republicans are thrilled with the tide they're seeing in their favor. They don't want to scuttle it at this point by looking obstructionist. Why do that? You don't have to. But the principle they're going to hold to until they don't is that those upper tax brackets are not, as the poll said, the wealthiest Americans. Those are small businessmen, many of whom file under the personal income tax code.
As the Democrats point out, you know, it's only a tiny percentage, I think 7%. Of small businessmen who actually make more than $250,000. Most of their money gets plowed back in. So as you've been saying, though, it's too soon to tell really where we're going on those Bush-era tax cuts. But you do know a little bit more about John Boehner than you did before this trip to Ohio. You went to every sort of nook and cranny that he ever hung out in, the bar where he had his first job, his family home. I mean, this is the guy sort of at the epicenter right now. President Obama put him front and center last week, mentioning him as an obstructionist 8 times in a speech. So what'd you find out about John Boehner and John Boehner country?
Well, just looking at the house he was born in is an experience. This is up a very steep hill, and it's a house with one bathroom and 3 bedrooms for 12 kids and 2 parents. It was one of these Sears and Roebuck houses built know, after World War II, tiny. And then you see where he, you know, where he is now, and it's an amazing transformation. Now, some of his family are still there. But in terms of his core set of beliefs that if you just buckle down and work hard, you can get out of anything. You can see it's written in his life story, which oddly enough he hasn't made much of. I mean, I've seen politicians make a whole lot more out of stories that involve nothing like the rags to riches, if you would put it that way, story his life embodies.
Well, what did you find among his constituents in Ohio? One thing we noted, something you call the revenge of the car dealers. What do you mean by that?
I kept running across, you know, Republicans who actually have a credible chance to win in districts that they would never have a shot at before, districts that have been solidly Republican for a long time, but the job situation is so desperate and people are so, you know, personally angry at what's happened in the last 2 years, the hope they had with Democrats taking power and then the reality that either they're not going to come out and vote at all or they're going to vote for somebody else, and it almost doesn't matter who. But where did these people come from? Well, and I talked to two in a row, Republicans, one in Erie, one in Canton, Ohio, who were both running car dealerships when the auto bailout came out, and they got letters from government bureaucrats saying, you know, we're going to shut your dealership down. And what made them the most angry is that the people they were talking to were 23, 24, 25 years old who didn't know anything about business, they said. And that became a kind of touch point. Both of them got into politics for that reason. Government is too big. It's spending too much. Oh, and by the way, they don't know anything about how to create jobs or run a business. I do. I'm going to Washington.
Well, and so the fact that President Obama is credited with saving the car industry with some of his moves means nothing to these car dealers who lost their dealerships.
That's right.
Yeah.
No, their dealership was doing fine. They can see no reason why it was shut down, and it's something that government did and not the market. That's the point that bugs them.
Yeah. You also heard a lot about the young guns movement on the part of the Republican Party. What, tell us about that.
Oh, that's interesting, too. The Republican National Campaign Committee and House Republicans created this term young guns and set up a contest. You know, Republicans who are running for office for the first time are eligible to be designated as young guns, and there's a whole process. You're first, you know, a part of the focus, and then you have to go through a procedure, and eventually you're picked. And I had one conversation just on Sunday with a Republican, McKinley, who's running in West Virginia, Alan Mollahan's old district, again with a credible chance to win in a Democratic district. And he said he was so thrilled to get a call the other day that he was a young gun because he was over 60, and it had been a very long time since he had been described either as young or as a gun of any kind. So it was a great moment. But again, he's someone who's in construction, doesn't like what's happening to the industry, and got into politics for that reason. And, you know, regardless of what the polls say, I know that people don't like Republicans. I know that they like Democrats better. But when you talk to them about how they're going to vote, what they talk about is their situation. I don't have a job. It is hopeless in this area. And I'll tell you, driving up and down the Ohio River, on either side of it, you'll see more rust and more decay in central cities and towns than I've seen in a lifetime. And you can see the despondency in some of these areas and why you might skip over the qualities of the incumbent altogether just to either register a protest vote, I'm angry, you know, vote for the Republican, or what's more concerning to Democrats right now, simply not bother to show up.
Gail Chadwick, Senior Congressional Correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor, speaking to us from the Monitor Studios in Washington. Thanks as always.
You're welcome.
Well, let's take a closer look at a few of the closely watched primary races tomorrow. There are primaries in seven states and the District of Columbia. In Delaware, a Democrat Joe Biden's Senate seat is up for grabs. In New Hampshire, Republican Senator Judd Gregg is retiring. In both, Tea Party-supported challengers are hard on the heels of establishment Republicans. So will tomorrow be a replay of Alaska's primary last month, where the Tea Party candidate upset GOP favorite Lisa Murkowski, who's now considering a write-in candidacy? Or will it be more like Arizona, where John McCain struggled at first but ultimately beat back Tea Party favorite J.D. Hayworth? Let's check in with Peter Walston, who covers politics for The Wall Street Journal. Peter, as Gail was just saying, the challenge for the Democrats is going to be to get Democrats as energized as Republicans are. The challenge for Republicans is wrangling cats, it would seem.
No, that's right, Robin. I mean, Republicans feel that their big advantage is the enthusiasm, as you pointed out. But the challenge is that a lot of them, that enthusiasm is coming from activists who tend to be much more conservative and more ideological than maybe the party strategists in Washington are accustomed to, who they think about winning races. So the establishment wanted Congressman Mike Castle to be the nominee in Delaware, and a lot of conservatives feel differently.
Well, let's take a look there. The big news in Delaware is this overnight poll showing Tea Party favorite Christine O'Donnell, who's been endorsed by Sarah Palin, with a 3-point lead now over the moderate Republican congressman and former governor Mike Castle. For those outside that region, how surprising is that?
Well, it's very surprising. I mean, first of all, that poll, that is within the margin of error, so it's possible that anything can happen. What that shows us, though, is that there's a tie, essentially, statistically. And yes, it's surprising. Mike Castle's a former governor. He's a very popular figure in the state. But he's on the liberal wing of the Republican Party, and it's a very small electorate in a Delaware Republican primary. So if you've got enthusiasm on your side, like Christine O'Donnell does, she could actually win.
Well, and even though she really has no experience in government, although that's, you know, as we know, maybe a good thing this election year. Let's listen to some of the back and forth. The Tea Party Express, again, an organization started and run by GOP political operatives, but fronted now by former flight attendant Amy Kramer, has parachuted in. They've spent $250,000 on ads like this one.
Michael Castle is attacking working class Christine O'Donnell, supporting the Obama agenda. $1 billion bailouts. Michael Castle, yes. O'Donnell will fight them.
So you've got that from the Tea Party Express in favor of Christine O'Donnell. And here's Mike Castle's ad against Christine O'Donnell. He only recently went negative.
Do you recognize this Delaware politician? Here's some hints. According to the News Journal, she didn't pay thousands in income taxes. Had to be sued by a university.
So, Peter Walston, how does this play out? Because some are saying this is the Republican Party cannibalizing itself.
That's what Christine O'Donnell is saying, certainly. But their party establishment is really going after her big time. I mean, they have just decided, the state Republican Party, the national party, they've decided she just could not be viable in a general election. So they're willing to just go all out against her, and they feel Mike Castle would win fairly easily. So for them, it's worth it. This is a big difference, though, from other campaigns where we've seen the Tea Party candidate come out of the box and overcome the establishment candidate, and ultimately you see the establishment kind of backing.
In this case, the Republicans have seen the candidate coming, and we'll hear more about what they're doing there. And also, we'll go up to New Hampshire with Peter Walston of the Wall Street Journal, taking a look at tomorrow's primaries. Later in the show, into the blues closet to pull out some vintage gems. Back in a minute, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide. On the web at MathWorks.com.
Welcome back. 7 states, including Massachusetts, where we are, and the District of Columbia, have primary elections tomorrow. We're taking a closer look at a couple, and we've been looking at Delaware, where former Governor Michael Castle is facing off against gadfly Christine O'Donnell in the Republican primary. Some are saying that this is the Republican Party cannibalizing itself, but here's Dick Armey. Now, Dick Armey's Freedom Works backs many in the Tea Party, and he told CNN's Candy Crowley on CNN yesterday that Tea Party candidates are middle of the road.
These candidates are the middle of American politics. Your own poll earlier revealed the American people are by and large disenchanted with both political parties. They want fiscal responsibility. They want fiscal restraint. They want good governments and creative new ideas.
Peter Walston covers politics for the Wall Street Journal. Peter, are the mainstream Republican leaders there in Delaware buying this?
No, not at all. I was just on the phone a few minutes ago with the Republican Party chairman of of Delaware. He's extremely using extremely strong language to say that Christine O'Donnell is not qualified. They've been distributing research on her, on her past, questioning her background, calling it a checkered past. So no, they're not buying it at all. They don't see her as a representative of that movement. And Tom Ross, the state party chairman, said that he's miffed at Sarah Palin and Senator Jim DeMint from South Carolina for coming in and endorsing her.
Well, another thing Christine O'Donnell has done in her candidacy is put social issues on the table. She's one of the things that she has done is fight against abortion rights. And this is not something that just the mainstream Republicans seem to want to keep off the radar, but the Tea Party activists haven't been going into social issues either.
They haven't, but again, the Tea Party movement is kind of a loose confederation. It's not. There are these groups like the Tea Party Express that are operating more strategically and spending a lot of money in different places. But folks who've been active, they haven't been active because of social issues. But it's still the abortion is still something that can drive voters to the polls for a specific reason. And Mike Castle is supports abortion rights, so it's a way to motivate conservatives. And again, this is a race where your listeners should remember we're talking about maybe 10,000 to 15,000 or 20,000 people voting. It's small enough that whatever reason you can, for whatever way you can get somebody to the polls, you get them there.
Well, and Peter Wallace, and we want to look at New Hampshire, but just a quick question. As we said, the Tea Party Express, backed by two longtime Republican consultants, Dick Armey, of course, a former a majority leader, backing other Tea Party candidates. One would think that the thinking initially, was that this would help the Republican Party. Now we see these big guns behind the Tea Party activists, being criticized by Republican leaders. How much backfighting is going on behind the scenes?
I don't know yet, and part of we'll have to see that in the coming weeks, especially once we get past tomorrow. In some states, there are like Alaska, for instance, where a Tea Party candidate beat Senator Murkowski in a primary. There's not been healing. Some of Senator Murkowski's supporters are still looking for ways for her to run. There's a few states where the fighting has continued. Other states like Kentucky, the establishment has moved behind. In that case, Rand Paul. In Nevada, the establishment has gotten behind Sharon Engel. So, these weren't their candidates to begin with, but they've gotten behind them in most of these states. It's just we're going to have to see how it plays out and whether the fighting continues and whether it hurts Republicans. And Democrats are very happy to see what's happening in Delaware right now.
Well, as a reminder that Tea Party activists don't all speak in one voice, we go to New Hampshire, where there's splits within the Tea Party backing factions. You've got Republican establishment candidate and state attorney general Kelly Ayotte, backed by Sarah Palin. And Kelly Ayotte is facing insurgent Ovid LaMontagne, who conservative talk show host Laura Ingraham calls the only true conservative in the race. And here's how LaMontagne paints himself.
I'm not the establishment candidate nor a new conservative trying to buy your vote, but I am the only candidate with a 15-point pledge. I'll work to cut spending, lower taxes, repeal Obamacare, and defend the right of states to protect their citizens. I'll commute to Washington, and I'll only serve you.
So there you have Ovid LaMontagne, a longtime mainstream Republican Party activist, not receiving money from the Tea Party Express, but getting grassroots Tea Party support. What's your read in New Hampshire?
That just goes to show you that none of this is easy to navigate, because as you pointed out, Sarah Palin endorsed the candidate who's the establishment candidate there. Kelly Ayotte is... Republicans think that she's in a much safer position at the moment than Mike Castle. Now, remember, New Hampshire plays an important role in presidential politics. That could explain why Sarah Palin chooses to go with the person most likely to win, as opposed to the insurgent. So that's at play as well. But I think in New Hampshire, we're going to see a more expected outcome there with Kelly Ayotte winning the primary.
Well, by the way, it is a very crowded field in that Republican primary. It includes businessman Bill Binney. We'll have the full list at our website, hereandnow.org. But in the minute or so we have left, couple minutes we have left here, what do you think Sarah Palin's effect on tomorrow's primaries will be?
Well, I mean, she's definitely put Christine O'Donnell, she and Jim DeMint, but I would say probably mostly Sarah Palin has put Christine O'Donnell in the running to win. She's had a big impact on the primaries throughout. She's had a few losses, but she's had a lot of wins, and she's a force. And this has continued to put her in that position. And she clearly drives a certain category, a certain element of the electorate. And that's more than probably any other single Republican has done.
And just one last question, Peter. We started by talking about some of the shifts we saw over the weekend. Republican John Boehner saying he might go ahead and vote for tax cuts for middle-class America and not for the wealthiest, saying that he might not hold up a bill. Do you see President Obama coming out swinging last week having any effect? You just have a few seconds, but do you see him making any dent?
Not yet, but it's too early yet to see whether he's going to have a dent. If he keeps this up for a month, that could have an effect, especially in the races that are very close, where Democrats still have a chance to win.
Peter Walston of The Wall Street Journal, ahead of tomorrow's primaries. Peter, thank you.
You're welcome.
And obviously, this is the story we're going to be watching for the next few weeks. We'll continue to do that for you. Latest news is next, though. Back with 1 minute, here and now.
Support for Here and Now comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Hinckley, Allen & Snyder, where partners have been giving clients practical legal advice for over 100 years throughout New England, and now including Connecticut, online at haslaw.com. And the Institute of Contemporary Art on the Boston waterfront. Discover the power and beauty of new art and ideas, icaboston.org.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Parliamentary elections are scheduled for Saturday in Afghanistan, and after last year's presidential elections, there are fears that fraud will be a major factor. But the bigger issue may be fear itself. Threats from the Taliban are keeping some candidates from campaigning outside of the main cities, and some polling centers have already closed before the elections are even held. The BBC's Ian Pannell reports from Ghazni, where the candidates who are campaigning are heavily armed and heavily protected.
Mahmoud Ghilani is one of the MPs for Ghazni. The insurgents say they'll kill anyone taking part in the election, and they've been true to their word. Candidates and their staff have been threatened, kidnapped, injured, and in some cases killed.
In these circumstances, elections in Afghanistan will be disastrous. It will be again a fraudulent election. People have lost their trust in the government, in the governance system.
Well, Mahmoud Ghilani and his entourage, his security detail, his bodyguards, his police protection have all turned up now in a Kuchi village. The Kuchis are an ethnic nomadic tribe in Afghanistan. He's sitting down at the moment, surrounded by a group of, I guess, about 100 to 200 men with large white turbans, big, long black or grey beards, and a lot of young boys, most of them with grubby faces, and as you can hear, a large amount of livestock, which tells you we're out in the countryside. And what he's doing is talking to the village elders, trying to persuade them to come out and vote for him. And the village elder is absolutely crucial, because if he can be persuaded, then he can bring everybody else in the village on board, and in this case, that could mean as many as 1,000 votes. But that system falls down if people are too scared to vote. And everyone we talked to in the town bazaar said they wouldn't take the risk.
I don't have a card. I'm not going to vote, because if I vote here, I will be slaughtered and beheaded there. If we vote here, they're going to cut our ears and noses there. So which one do you want to sue?
Have you been threatened directly, or just everybody knows?
Well, this has happened before. People have been beheaded and killed. They will take you out of the car on the highway.
These are the people they're afraid of, the Taliban, singing ballads that call for the defense of the country. The songs are kept on mobile phones or cassettes and played by travelers who risk being stopped at insurgent checkpoints. Out in the countryside, more than 20 militants roam freely on their motorbikes, rifles and rocket-propelled grenade launchers on show.
The insurgents train for attacks. This recording was made for us by a local journalist who put our questions to one of the top Taliban commanders, Mullah Rouhani.
Elections aren't possible here. Last year, during the presidential race, a few people came by helicopter and stuffed the ballot boxes. Today, the district is under the total control of the Islamic Emirate of Afghanistan. No candidate, election worker, or voter can enter. We, the Mujahideen of the Emirate, will defend every step of Ghazni province. Jews and their slaves will not step their foot onto our land.
Back on the election trail, Mahmoud Ghilani says 14 of the 18 districts in Ghazni are now in insurgents' hands, which means nearly a third of all polling stations will stay closed. For many, this election has now become a matter of life or death.
Are you afraid that you might lose your life in this pursuit?
Yes, of course. Every day I'm worried, my family is worried, but we have this aim to take out Afghanistan of the current crisis. If it means risking your life, I will go ahead with it.
In the few days we've spent here, one candidate has been attacked with a grenade, others targeted in a massive car bomb in the city centre. Many provinces have similar stories. After last year's fiasco in the presidential election, the credibility of the government and the international mission depends on the parliamentary vote being a success. But once again, security and corruption could undermine that hope.
That report from the BBC's Ian Pannell in Afghanistan. Well, in about 10 minutes, we go to Chicago to hear some blues before sunrise, some of the blues greats. Up next, China's investments in Africa. That's in 30 seconds, here and now. The Commission for Africa, set up by former British Prime Minister Tony Blair, has a new report showing what it calls dramatic economic growth in Africa, growth fueled in good part by China. Chinese companies are laying railroad tracks, building highways and ports, investing in mining and agriculture on a scale not seen since the European empires. Well, reporter Howard French traveled across the continent to see if the Chinese era will leave Africans better off than the Europeans did. And he came away with some concerns. His article in The Atlantic magazine is titled The Next Empire, and he joins us now from the studios of the Radio Foundation in New York. And Howard, you started your trip in the old port city of Dar es Salaam in Tanzania. Today, it's ringed with large cranes over Chinese construction sites. You describe Chinese merchants on the streets, even an upscale Chinese brothel, a lot being brought into the area.
Absolutely. Yeah. This range of activities is typical of Chinese involvement wherever they go in the world. This would be familiar to us here in this country by the almost universal presence of Chinese food anywhere that you look. Early Chinese arrivals generally occupy many of those lower niches that we're familiar with, but at the same time, they're occupying many other niches that may be less visible, big construction or other services. In Africa, one of the big industries that Chinese have come to dominate very quickly is the wireless telephone business. And then, of course, as you mentioned, the sort of high-end, behind-high-walls prostitution market.
And you paint a picture initially, anyway, in which African leaders sort of drool over the money and investment that China brings. Well, for China, you know, Africa is the source of at least a third of the world's commodities. And you quote a couple of experts with a pretty optimistic view of this symbiosis. You have a South African scholar who says Chinese trade has been a phenomenal success story, and Dambisa Moyo, the London-based African economist, who's been a critic of Western aid and conversely says the Chinese are our friends. What does she mean?
Dambisa Moyo's main argument is that Western aid distorts the incentives for economic growth and development. It distorts incentives in ways that allow African governing elites to simply nurse what economists would call rents. In other words, predictable incomes from predictable sources, aid being a predictable income source, then that's really all you need to do. If you can live off of rents that way, there's no pressure for you to progress or to be more ambitious in terms of your development agenda.
And I guess her more pertinent point is that unlike the West, China focuses on investment rather than aid or subsidized loans, doesn't tell African governments how to run their countries or make its investments contingent on reform, and therefore it moves faster, according to Moyo.
Well, the problem with that argument is the exact same problem with her argument against aid. The very same elites that could live off of extracting benefit from Western aid are the elites that will control the contracts that will be let to Chinese mining companies and Chinese infrastructure project developers. These big projects all go through the presidential palace, and very little of the benefit will flow to the populace or into the budget in a way that could help develop the country and advance the economy.
Well, this is what you find, but, you know, as Moyo says, in welcoming China with more open arms, maybe what Africa needs is a commercial partner, not a high-minded scold. But as you started to see the result of China's huge investments in Africa, you started to see that it wasn't as simple as that and that people were seeing problems. Like what?
Well, like in Zambia, for example, where the Chinese have come in a fairly short period of time to control a large part of the market, there's great dissatisfaction with the Chinese among many Zambians, that the Chinese bring in lots of workers of their own to do a whole range of activities, from high-end, very high-skilled things that one could make an argument you need the foreign expert to do, all the way to very low-end stuff that Africans are almost literally sometimes starving or dying for in order to have those sorts of opportunities. There's a lot of dissatisfaction with disrespect for unions and for the right to organize the workforce. There's a lot of dissatisfaction with perceived corruption. And this has sort of had its rebound in Zambian politics, where the presence of the Chinese and the predominance of the Chinese increasingly in the copper industry has become a very hot political issue.
Officials in a province back in China have been publicly encouraging workers to go to Africa. There's a blurb from the South China Morning Post saying that people from this area are well experienced in agricultural mass production in China. While in Africa, there's plenty of land, but food production is unsatisfactory. And you met Africans who fear, wait a second, I'm not going to be the one to get to farm this big industrial farm maybe that China is investing in. It's going to be Chinese workers.
I think that over time, this may come to be seen as the most important issue of all in terms of China's engagement with Africa. Africa is at the present moment, in a sort of deceptive way, relatively underpopulated and certainly relatively underproductive in terms of agricultural output. I say deceptively because Africa's population is growing extremely fast and will essentially double over the next 50 years. And so the idea of China, which has huge food needs of its own, and China, which has great experience with agriculture and very productive workers coming in and boosting African productivity in the agricultural sphere, is a very seductive one in many ways, but it's also an explosive one because land issues among Africans resonate with all sorts of importance. This is at the root of much of identity in Africa, ethnically speaking, and there are all sorts of ancestral customs and traditional land rights and practices that are very complicated, and having outsiders come in and take possession of land, I see this as a potential powder keg in many places.
Well, and as you point out, Africans have very sharp, real, present memories of colonialization, of being displaced. And you met a lawyer in Congo who's kind of coming to the conclusion that maybe the Chinese look in appearance like business partners, but they may end up just replacing others who've exploited the continent in the past. It's the same template.
This is a very tricky topic because I don't think that China can be fairly accused of deliberately seeking to reproduce the template of European imperialism. At the same time, certain similar outcomes are possible, that China being its interest in Africa being driven certainly to a very large extent by interest in natural resources, that China can come in and tap these resources in deals with corrupt political elites. What is the end result of a process like that? For me, it's very frightening. African countries, which are then horribly overpopulated and completely resource depleted, and the world is left with African problems of a dimension I don't think we've even begun to imagine.
That's Howard French, a professor of journalism at Columbia, a former foreign correspondent for the New York Times, an author and photographer. Howard, we understand you're working on a book about this future that you see of Africa.
Yes, it's a book about Chinese migration to Africa and looking at the actual experiences of initial waves of what I expect to be very, very large numbers of Chinese people moving to Africa to do business there and ultimately to settle there.
Howard French, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And when we come back, a blues lesson here and now.
Support for Here and Now comes in part from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org.
For over 30 years, Steve Cushing has been playing the blues as a musician, but also as the host of Blues Before Sunrise. That's the radio show where, as Steve says, every week is Black History Month, the history being that of the first 50 years of recorded blues. The show was launched in 1980 on Chicago's WBEZ. Early on, old-timers in Chicago would call Steve up and point him to unknown living treasures. Now he's syndicated with a collection of rare conversations with people who lived and made the blues, people like guitarist Jesse Thomas.
A lot of that, what you hear me doing on a guitar, was trying to make it go like a saxophone and a clarinet, but it never would. You can't make a saxophone out of a guitar, so I just come up with that sound.
Well, now Steve Cushing has collected his favorites of over 30 years of interviews in the new book, Blues Before Sunrise, The Radio Interviews. And Steve joins us from WBEZ in Chicago. Welcome.
Thank you.
Boy, what a treat. And I loved how you described how early on elderly listeners in Chicago would help you out. I mean, here you are, this young white guy, and they were filling you in. For instance, there was a record by Slim and Slam, A Tip on the Numbers, in which a guy sings about placing a bet on a gas meter, and listeners explained what to you?
In the old days, people would rent single rooms, and within the single room that they would rent, there would usually be a coin-operated hot plate, and it operated on quarters. And so it became known as a gas meter. If you played the number for a gas meter, it was for 25 cents.
What's the matter?
Well, I tell you. Hey, look here, Pops. Lay a couple of gas meters on me, man.
A couple of gas meters?
Yes, that's right.
There was another reference. Ma Rainey sings a line, he ain't good looking, he ain't got poro'd hair.
That made reference to the poro school of beauty based here in Chicago, and basically it meant that he didn't have his hair processed.
Yeah, so there was all this great detail that you learned and then could tell listeners about the blues and Chicago. It's such a rich collection. We've picked just a few of the interviews that we could fit in, starting with Alberta Hunter. Of course, she became a blues legend, but as she tells you, she was literally a runaway, you know, who came to Chicago to try to sing. One of the things Alberta Hunter talked to you about was recording during pre-World War II days when there weren't even microphones. Let's first of all listen to a song that she wrote and sings, Empty Cellar Blues.
Empty cellar, empty cellar, rang murder on my mind. Empty cellar, empty cellar.
You asked her to describe how these recording sessions went. There were holes in the wall. Explain.
They didn't start recording electronically through microphones until around 1925. And prior to that, they did a process called acoustic recording. And if you see the old Victrolas or gramophones where the sound comes out of this big horn, it's actually the exact opposite process. You sing into the horn, and then the lathe that would cut the wax on the turntables was in an adjoining room with engineers. And so the real artistry there was placing a vocalist and then not having the instrumentalist drown them out. That's why for the first couple of years of acoustic recordings, there were no drums, because drums would drown everything out.
Well, let's go to another subject. Jody Williams. Let's listen to his song, Looking for My Baby, and then talk about Jody Williams.
I've been looking for my baby since the sun started sinking low. Yes, I've been looking for my baby since the sun started sinking low. Now won't someone tell me where did she go?
Jody Williams there with a much more contemporary sound. He had played with Howlin' Wolf, Bo Diddley, but had an infamous falling out with Bo Diddley. It had to do with the song Love is Strange, which was ultimately recorded by Mickey and Sylvia. Explain that to us.
Jody always claimed that he wrote that tune, and actually there's a form of it that's available by a soul singer named Billy Stewart. And he was working with Bo Diddley. they were playing on the same package as Mickey and Sylvia. And they were playing this tune over and over again. And Mickey Baker, famed R&B guitarist, would sit at the end of the stage behind the curtain and listen to it and soak it in. Well, actually, Bo Diddley went to Mickey Baker and said, "Let me sell you this song." Then he went back to Jody and said, "I've sold your song to Mickey Baker, and don't worry about it." He says, "We're all going to get money out of this when it becomes a hit." Mm-hmm. But apparently it never happened. So.
Well, let's listen to Jody Williams' version as performed by Billy Stewart in the song Billy's Blues, and we'll follow that with Mickey and Sylvia's Love is Strange. Love is strange. Boy, you can sort of hear it in there. Let's hear Mickey and Sylvia.
This was a gigantic hit, so there was considerable amount of money that Jody didn't get.
Yeah. Well, you talk about Tommy Brown, who influenced another Brown, James Brown, and probably one of his most well-known songs was this one, Weepin' and Cryin'. I don't know how many times you've heard that song, but does it still get you a little bit?
I think of his histrionics on the stage, because he wouldn't just pretend to cry. He would fall to the ground. He would pound the stage. He would fall off the stage. And James Brown would come around and see Tommy in performance. And on more than one occasion, when Tommy would come around James Brown in performance, James would intentionally stop the show, introduce Tommy to the audience, and say, "This is the man who made me what I am. He's the man who laid down the template for all the things that you see me doing on stage today. I got all of those from Tommy Brown."
Lord, and pour coffee in my head.
We just want to touch on one last one. We said, you know, you're a longtime broadcaster, but growing up white in the Chicago suburbs, you were not familiar with Richard Stamms, who was at one time one of the biggest stars in Chicago radio, at least in the African-American community. His was one of the biggest African-American stations in the country, the first to have national advertising.
Yeah, he was wonderful to talk with, and just a fireball.
Well, let's listen.
That's the power. That's the clout we had. We sold them. We fired them if they didn't do right. And we had some automobile dealers that didn't do right. We had to get rid of them.
Well, so you, Steve Cushing, are going to just stay in the past. And your listeners, thank you for it. What would you like to go out on that represents that past?
The best way to do this would be to go out with my closing theme each week, which has nothing to do with blues in the past. It's Fleetwood Mac, when they were a blues band, and they had an instrumental theme called Albatross.
Not so stuck in the past. That's longtime Chicago radio host Steve Cushing. His syndicated radio show is Blues Before Sunrise. His book is Blues Before Sunrise, the radio interviews. For more, go to our website, herenow.org. Steve, thanks.
Thank you.